Okay, I want us to discuss today a new lesson in a brand new book that we're getting into, and it's Jonah. However, once again, before we get into actually reading the book of Jonah and discussing it, we have to understand the world as Jonah would have understood it. Because if we do not, then we're going to end up falling in the same trenches, in the same ditches that everybody before us has fallen into. Now, I'm not saying that I'm going to be teaching some grand new philosophy or whatever out of the book of Jonah. What I am saying, though, if you're going to use the normative hermeneutical methodology of understanding the scriptures, then you have to understand Jonah's worldview. And to do that, we need to try to understand the world of Jonah and not our world today. We can't take our 21st century worldview back and lay it on top of Jonah's 8th century BCE world or before Christ world and say, okay, now I understand it, because we won't. We're not going to have a clue at all as to what is going on in the book of Jonah. And I think some of the things that we're going to talk about will surprise you. Everyone says, oh, it's history, it's boring. Well, I'm going to try and make it not so boring. And I'm going to be covering some older concepts. So if you've been following along in some of my other studies, this will be a review for you. But if not, if you haven't, then this will be different material than probably what you're used to hearing. So let's get started. And we're going to pick it up with a timeline of mankind post-diluvian. It means after the flood, as it's written in the Bible. Though in Hebrew, it's not called the flood, it's called the cataclysm. That's what it means in Hebrew. Once again, the flood was only a small part of what was actually going on in the earth. The flood just kind of cushioned Noah and those 8 on the ark. But there was much, much more going on than just the flood. That's why in Hebrew it's called the cataclysm. It's actually much more accurate than our English use of the word flood. And so if you're not used to the way I teach, I try to get you to understand the Hebrew or the Greek behind your language. It's good to have the Bible in your language. It absolutely is. It is a wonderful thing. But that's only the beginning of your study. It can't stop there. You can't rest there. How do you know that the words your translator picked or the translators pick for your language are the best words? They have issues. They have agendas. They make errors. And so I encourage everyone to try to get a smattering, at least a smattering of Greek and Hebrew under their belt, so they can look at the meaning of the words and determine for themselves. Now, you're not going to be language experts. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not going to make you a history expert, because I'm not one. Neither am I a language expert. And the more I study the Bible, the more ignorant I believe I am even in the things of God. I'm just trying to give to you what I've learned, so that hopefully you won't make the same mistakes, get caught in the same traps I did. And thus, you will benefit and profit by more years of study, of true study, and grow in the grace of Christ. So we start off with Nimrod at Haran. This is where what's commonly called the Tower of Babel was built. And if you want to get into that, you have to go look at my study in Genesis, where I cover that in much more detail. It wasn't at Babylon, And we'll touch on that in a moment as to why it wasn't at Babylon, as you've probably have been erroneously taught, unfortunately. But from this Haran, they were scattered. And they move outward. So Nimrod's kingdom, it was a one-world kingdom because it was the only kingdom. It was a prototype. He had built a ziggurat, ascending up the steps with the altar on top, with the sacrifice thereon, so everyone could see. And the smoke from that sacrifice would rise up even further toward heaven. That's what was happening at the Tower of Babel. It was not building a tower to reach God. It was building up so that he could unite the people around himself as the intercessory, the mediator between God and man, between God and them. And that would make him a God also. And so that's where this comes from, this concept of God-man in idolatry. And we see this in the very ancient kingdoms. And if you want to gain more understanding of what I mean when I say very ancient kingdoms and ancient kingdoms, I would send you back to my study in Exodus in the first three lessons, in which I go into more detail about that. And thus you'll have a better understanding of what I'm saying for here. But nevertheless, we're just giving you the basics here so you'll understand Jonah's worldview. And so the kingdom of Nimrod becomes a prototypical kingdom of all those that arise afterwards. And it's copied in one form or another. And it's altered because of their understanding, their cultural understandings. And so Nimrod built Nineveh. And you go Babylon later as the waters of the cataclysm had receded because the ice age in both the northern and southern latitudes. And these are the middle latitudes, so the water receded from them first. But there's still a lot of water left on the lands. And so we had the one single ice age that dried out the atmosphere and took this excess water and froze it, and that's the north cap is actually all water, whereas the southern cap, southern pole, is land covered with ice and surrounded by ice. And so that's a lot of water to pull away, and it happened slowly over time. By slowly, I mean over 100-200 years or so. So as these waters receded, these other groups migrated following the waters, as well as the other groups moved into other areas. And thus your myth of the caveman was born. Because as they got closer to these areas of ice, they had fewer options, you know, to develop dwellings. There's no trees, few grasses, there's malnutrition, you're misshapen. Rickets and so on and so forth, and they were living in caves hunting animals. But as these waters receded, their lives changed, their diets changed culturally. Thus, each group reinterpreted Nimrod's God-man rule, or his kingdom. And they did it based on their particular worldview. Now, as these groups separated, God changed their language, which means he changed their understanding, which means he changed the worldview. And as they subdivided off and isolated themselves away from each other, this began to change quite dramatically in relationship to other people. And as you see in this Bible timeline that I've labeled Prehistory Man's Timeline, you had people who migrated to China, to the Indus Valley, some who stayed in the Mesopotamia area, others who went to Egypt. Remember, man has always been spreading outward from this one spot. He spread into northern latitudes and the southern latitudes, and eventually made it across over into what, according to European explorers, became the New World. Because when they got there, there were people there. And they got there not because God created more races. There's only one race of men. They got there because they migrated there. So each ethnos, or each culture, adapted truth according to their worldview. Because that's basically what you do. You're establishing your truths. And your truths are based upon your values. And that forms your religion. And so it's not, you have your religion, and then you have your values, and then you have your expressions of it and how you worship and stuff. They're all bound up together. So it's interesting that modern man has labeled ancient man's history according to technology, because that was important to us. Well, it was important to ancient man, too. But ancient man in his writings never really identified himself as such by his technology. They did it by their ethnicity, their culture, their belief system. And that's what differentiated one kingdom from another kingdom. That, and as they isolated themselves, their outward features, they were inbreeding within themselves, so those who were born different were probably pushed outward and migrated outward to form their own group or to join another group that looked more like they did. That's just what sinful man does. And so in the Copper Age, you have the three early kingdoms, the Sumer, the Akkadian, and Egypt. And Egypt is going to stay the existing very ancient kingdom until it's conquered by Alexander the Great, Greek, and then it's taken over by Ptolemy upon his death, from whom Cleopatra springs. She's not Egyptian, she's Greek. Next we have the Bronze Age, and Assyria comes into being during this time period in the region around Nineveh. You have to remember, there are previous slides, you had these kingdoms, Sumer, Akkadian, and Egypt, but they're not extensive. They're along rivers, and they're controlling those rivers, and they're beginning to consolidate themselves. And the god, and the, your king is both king and high priest, or the god king, who's the intercessor between you and whomever you're calling God. But now in the Bronze Age, you see these kingdoms coalescing and growing and pushing against each other. And this causes more migration outward across the face of the earth. Remember what God told Noah when he came off the ark. Populate, be fruitful, and spread out across the earth. And they immediately decided not to do that. And that was the purpose of Babel, was to change the world, to change their understanding, and reveal that aspect of their sin nature that hates differences in each other, and they would repel themselves and spread out across the face of the earth. This is just God's plan working itself out through the self-interest of sinful man. That's what we do. We don't like differences. We push them away and we congregate with those that have like values or similar values like ours. And we further subdivide within that. But during this time period, Assyria was basically weak. And it was dominated by the Mitannis and then later on the Hittites. And if you're following along in the graphic, which I include with each of these lessons, you'll see that on these maps here that I've included. Now, Ashur was the name of their main god. And that was also the name of their capital city was Ashur. Yes, they built Nineveh and they occupied around it, but it was not to be their capital city for a long time. And then this next slide here, we see we're in the Iron Age. And I'm just giving just a brief overview of how mankind spread out. So you get an understanding that in the time of Jonah, mankind is still spreading out. Now, in our day and time, we think that everything's all settled, and so we're just quibbling over land. Well, we're still spreading out and displacing each other. That's what sinful people do. And we're trying to now bring a global order to things to stop that, which means that we have to make everybody the same. And thus, there could be no differences because you have to be the same. But that's not part of this lesson, so let me not digress there too much. I would point you to some of my posts on discernlife.com if you want to get more understanding of that, of how that concept plays out in the modern world today. Now, sure, their God, according to the Assyrians, demanded that as a nation, as an empire, they had to constantly expand or they would die out. There would be an apocalypse and they would cease to exist. And so here you have a people, first that I'm aware of in my studies here, that as a group, it was demanded that they conquer others or they would go extinct. And this is going to be their driving force. And they don't start off very good at it. That's why the Mitannis overpowered them, and then later on the Hittites. However, by the time we get to the Iron Age, Assyria has decided that she needs to use technology. And she is the first to use iron weapons to develop them. And she's thus that makes her the first kingdom, the first empire to enter the Iron Age. So now she's able to expand and in this time period build a stronger, more unified empire. Now, we have between the Bronze Age and the Iron Age, we have what's called the collapse of the Bronze Age. And during this period, almost all the Bronze Age civilizations seem to just shrivel up. And some actually disappear and are replaced by others. And it was no different with the Assyrians. They didn't disappear, but they did hit this period of decline and stagnation until she was able to develop the iron weapons and also begin to grow and expand outward. Well, this axial age usually runs from 800 to 200 BC, and it is this period of expanding burst of growth. Assyria declined. Now she's beginning to expand outward, and she enters into Bible history, and we're going to discuss that later on. But just so you know, most Christians are aware of the Assyrians because of their interactions with the Israelites in the Old Testament. There's not a lot of interaction, but there are a few, and they cover quite a period. So that's how most Christians are aware that the Assyrians did in fact exist, because she interacted with the northern kingdom of Israel. Now, as I said before, Ashur was the name of the god, and thus it was the first capital city. Now, later on, Kalach, which is going to be another major city near Nineveh, is going to be made its capital. And then finally, after the events in Jonah, Nineveh, which is a very ancient city, will become the capital. So each of these, in turn, becomes a capital. But in the very early stages, it's Ashur. And if you look on the map I provided, you'll see that they're all within a small geographical area of each other. Now, Assyria is an extremely interesting empire. And I did not know this until I started studying for Jonah. But she had great achievements. that have been copied by empires after her, and in some form or fashion, we're still using today. First of all, her civil achievements were done to support her military achievements. Everything had a military focus on it, to expand the empire, to hold the empire, to conquer others. Even trade was to bring in wealth to expand the military. And that seems very familiar with America and other nations today. So they're one of the first to develop a centralized administration system, because as their empire expanded, and it was the first to really expand over time, that's a large area, and you have to develop an administration system and a series of roads to go along with that, so you can administer and manage those diverse populations that are within your great boundaries. They're more than a day or two walk away or ride away. They're hundreds of miles away and further later on in their time period. And they were also the first to develop a library, and that library was placed at, you have it, Nineveh. And though their language was Akkadian, the Aramaic language came into widespread use and became their administrative language, along with the cuneiform writing system. And the Aramaic language is still spoken in pockets even today. And parts of the Old Testament are actually written Aramaic. In fact, when the Jews went to Babylon, they forgot Hebrew and were learning and speaking Aramaic. So when they came back, the priests would read the scrolls in Hebrew, and the scribes would translate them from Hebrew to Aramaic so the people could understand what was being read. So unlike Catholicism in the medieval times, well, up until the 20th century, when the masses were done in Latin and you either had to understand Latin or someone had to translate it for you. And they recognized that though other nations' gods had different names, they were all kind of the same. In other words, Ashur was the god, their god, but he was the god everywhere, but other nations just called them by different names. So when they conquered those people, they assured them that their gods were the same as their gods. And thus they would incorporate their gods into the conquered people's gods into their pantheon. But they were all unified by the same basic truth values system as exemplified in their religion. Their practices were somewhat different, but over time they smoothed out and became the same. And we know this is an actual fact, because since everyone descended from Nimrod, all these kingdoms, they had to be the same. But culturally, as their languages changed and as their practices changed, they would have different expressions for the same gods. They might add more, they might change some, but basically they're going to be pretty much the same. Now, Assyria's military achievements were there to support their expansionist demands. You usually don't come in and make friends and take over the territory because you're such good guys. It just never seems to work that way with sinful men. You come in, you're going kick butt, take names, take what you want. Well, the Assyrians were the first ones to really make an art form of this, for good and for bad. Now, according to Clausewitz, and he was one of the interpreters of Napoleon in the early 19th century, he says, war is merely the continuation of policy by other means. In other words, it's part of their diplomatic policy. It's probably one of their first arrows that they'll pick. So being the first to make iron weapons gave them a tactical strategic advantage, a tactical advantage on the battlefield, because iron weapons are stronger, more durable, less brittle than bronze weapons, sharper, and they hold their edge longer and easier to maintain and repair. Thus, and will pierce bronze armor, leather, and whatever they were using to cover themselves with for protection. But it gave them better tactics. Like I said, they developed a road system for trade and military usage. They were the first to develop siege engines. Remember, a lot of the cities they were going up against were walled. And thus, if you got too close, they'd dump hot oil on you or rocks or shoot arrows at you. And you basically had your tiny shield for protection. Well, the Assyrians said, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to develop siege engines and cover them with leather so the flaming arrows, when they hit the leather, would not ignite it. It's hard for leather to burn. And to do this, they could breach the walls over the tops, or they could eventually, these were developed to launch rocks to break down the walls, thus early forms of artillery, but I'm not sure that was associated directly with the Assyrians or not. They developed the two-wheeled chariot with archer who was and a driver and defender. It would hold up the shield so the archer could do his thing. This is much more maneuverable than earlier chariots, which were heavy affairs, less maneuverable. And they developed cavalry, horse, to ride in and support of the infantry. Well, Alexander the Great used that to great effect, and it was still being used in the 19th century. In fact, it's still being used in the 21st century in the form of armored vehicles. Now, what they did do is they started deporting upper classes elsewhere in their kingdom. And so if they came and conquered you, they would remove most of your upper class, your rulers, your top merchants, your priests and stuff. They would absorb them elsewhere in their kingdom, and then they would import other upper class into your area to manage you and to attend to your religious needs and so on and so forth. And they did that to quell rebellions, because if they left you as an intact society, you're going to want to rebel. They're going to have lots of troops stationed in lots of places. Now, what they did not do, as far as I could tell in my readings, was that when they deported you elsewhere into the kingdom, you were not slaves. You were just absorbed into their culture and were considered Assyrians. And thus, you were very quickly absorbed in and lost any national identity, because you were now Assyrian, just in another part of Assyria. And that's going to have implications for us later on in our discussions here. But they were masters of fear. They were a fierce enemy, not to be trifled with. And the conquered could expect piercings of lips and limbs, flayed or boiled alive with skins on display on these city walls, beheaded with heads on display, hanging from trees, up on poles, stacked up on the grounds, and women and children could be sold into slavery. Especially the soldiers, this was performed against those that were trained in arms and could lead future rebellions. They did not want to leave anybody behind that was going to be a problem. And so intimidation really was another war weapon for them. And when they'd come up to a city, they would ask it to surrender. And if they did, probably very little happened. And when they did not, you could expect this to happen once you were defeated. And so Ashur and King, as head of the religion, demanded punishment. Remember, they had to expand or face the apocalypse. That was their philosophy. That is their worldview. That is what constantly drove them. Expand or die. So what's the importance of Assyria? Through its strong influence, Assyria brought many nomadic tribes under its leadership, bringing stability to the area. He said, well, that was terrible for them to do that. Well, it was terrible for the Soviet Union to have been formed and to have killed 23 million of its citizens just to maintain its culture. And that's not counting the death in war. That's just killing those off just to establish yourself. But yet when the Soviet Union faded away, all those groups that had held in check in the Middle East, but in Eastern Europe, rose to the surface again. Now, in my day, we forgot about how dangerous those various ethnic groups were, how they started World War I and bombed and killed each other. But yet here they are, back in the forefront, and in a short time, there were American troops stationed in those areas that used to be under Soviet domination and were quiet, because now they're trying to slaughter each other again. So this is what Assyria was doing. It was conquering these nomadic tribes, which were very fierce, but could not stand up against a determined, organized army. And they were subduing them. And yes, they took over the territory, but they were changing their culture too, making them less nomadic, making them more countrified, I guess, would be a word to use. In other words, they were getting them used to what we call civilization, living on farms, living in towns, having a trade, making a living, a stable life system, rather than constantly being on the move. You never develop anything when you're constantly on the move. It's only when you settle down and your basic needs are met, then you start thinking of other things, like discovering electricity or discovering writing or doing any of these other things. You have time to think. And so Assyria was actually a stabilizing influence throughout the Mesopotamia area. And with its common language, it facilitates trade and wealth, not only for itself, but for those it traded with. It developed trading posts on the Mediterranean and other areas. And with this system of roads, it was able to tax, too. I'm sure they did. Everybody else did. But trade also brings influences from other cultures far away. And so there's this blending. You're trading not only goods, but you're trading words, you're trading ideas, you're trading philosophies and concepts. And thus the law, being different, invited investigation by others. Now, it would invite investigation by others because you want to know about peoples around you, especially nearby, whether they were a threat or not, and why were they different? And is that difference going to be a problem? Is it going to cause others around them to rise up against you, or to rise that nation, allow that nation to rise up against you? And thus this blending and flowing of ideas and culture is not unique to our times. It is the way it's always been in mankind. Man has always been investigative and talkative and exploring and trading and changing when he has been killing and destroying. Now, Assyria leading up to Jonah's time, you have to remember that being an ancient king, a very ancient kingdom, that Assyria has been around for a while. And it first makes its appearance in the Bible in the period of the Judges, as Assyrian expansion into Syria caused the population in Syria to flee. He had this refugee population, and they fled through Israel into Egypt. Now, according to the Egyptians, they were stripping the land like locusts. They were just hungry, and they were eating anything and everything they'd get their hands on. But during the period of the Judges, that's about 1280s to 1240s B.C. Then later on, in what would become known as the Neo-Assyrian time frame, and that's not what they call themselves. That's what modern man, the label modern man, has put on that kingdom on the Assyrians post-Bronze Age, when they came back in force and started expanding outward again. Shalmaneser IV lost Syria, Jehu, the Israel king. He paid tribute to Shalmaneser III, who ruled from 860 to 830. Shalmaneser IV lost Syria, and he ruled 791 to 781 approximately. All these dates are approximate. And we see that Assyria enters a period of decline. And then Ashur-nirari V is a weak king. And the power of the governors, and the governors are, we would call them mayors, but they're actually more than mayors, because they don't only control these major cities, but they control the territory around the major cities, like Nineveh and Calah and Ashur. And the power of the governors grow during this time period from 762 to 754. And so this is going to be the time of Jonah, when he goes to Nineveh. The Assyrian king is weak. The power of the governors is beginning to grow. In fact, one of these governors is going to later on make himself king. And thus, God sends Jonah into Assyria with this message during this time of confusion, weakness, stagnation. Otherwise, Jonah probably would not have gotten very far. Assyria, we tend to think of these things as monolithic and unchanging, or at least I did. Babylon is Babylon. Germany is Germany. America is America. They never change. No, they constantly change. They're constantly growing and adapting, expanding and contracting. And Assyria was no different. It was a dynamic empire, and it was in flux with periods of expansion and contraction as they responded to both internal and external events. You know, as they grew weak, people around them, cultures around them, felt emboldened to break away or attack them. And they would go into a period of decline until another strong man rose up, charismatic leader, invigorated the people, reorganized the army, whatever he had to do, and go back out and reconquer and expand the territory. Well, during Jonah's time, Assyria was in a confused state. The king was weak both internally and externally, and the governors of the provinces of the major cities were becoming much more powerful, as we just mentioned that. But Nineveh was always a major city since antiquity, since it was one of the first cities built. Not the first, but one of the first. Because after Babel, Nineveh was built by Nimrod. That was where he went and those people that followed him. So Nineveh has always had this charismatic mystique about it, because Nimrod was there. Now on this map here, you see Assyria at its zenith, at its farthest expansion. And you see it goes from Egypt up through the Levant and into Mesopotamia, Turkey, up almost to the Caspian Black Seas, down to the Persian Gulf. I mean, it was a huge territory to control. So it becomes the first major empire. And many of its achievements, like I said earlier, were copied by later empires and are still used today. Unfortunately, it was limited by the technology of its day, because to control an empire, meant you had to have better means of communication, and they just were not available to them. And so after a period of time, they're going to actually become splintered and be defeated. Now, the problem is, when we read the Bible, and I had this very same problem early on, Assyria and Syria, Assyria, Syria. What kind of writer would write this way? Would have two kingdoms with a similar name, so close in spelling and pronunciation that it was almost impossible to keep them straight. And this is a problem, you know, with Christians, as they're reading the scriptures. It's already confusing enough because it's ancient history. We don't understand the history. We don't understand the names. We don't understand the languages. The way they speak is strange. Everything about the Old Testament is strange. And it's different. It's not how we speak today. It's not how we would do things today. And thus, people get frustrated very quickly in reading the Old Testament, especially when the names are similar, Assyria and Syria. And then when they're fighting each other, you're going, oh my goodness, Assyria is fighting Syria. And you just, well, let somebody lose and now let's have only one name. And also because Christians just consider themselves basically New Testament Christians, they don't pay much attention to the Old Testament. And thus, other than trying to pick out prophecy and determining Christ's return and a few other odds and ends, they tend to just close the pages and ignore it. We have to be careful that we do not fall into that trap. God wrote that whole book, and he wrote that whole book for a reason. And if we're going to understand God's doctrine and God's theology, we have to understand the Old Testament, because the Old Testament teaches by example, excuse me, what the New Testament teaches by precept. And it is essential for us, if we're going to know God and know God's plan and know why God is doing what he's doing even today, we have to have a better grasp of the Old Testament. That's why I started teaching out of the Old Testament several years ago, because I just became burdened with my lack of understanding of the Old Testament. And then I wanted to share that with others. And I've learned so much that pertains to the New Testament. How one informs the other. Paul did not have the New Testament. He was writing the New Testament later on, but he did not have it. And Christ did not have the New Testament. When they're talking about the Bible, they're talking about the Old Testament. When Christ is teaching to the people on the road to Emmaus out of the scriptures, quoting them one after another, how they all talked about him, talked about the Yeshua who had to come and die and rise again, that's what he taught from. Thus, it's relevant. It's all relevant. In fact, the post I just wrote about the myth of racism comes almost entirely out of the Old Testament. And then I close it up with Paul out of the New Testament, showing why it's misused, why it's there. Thus, we have to understand and become serious about studying that part of the Bible. That's two-thirds of the Bible. It's like buying a 1,000-page murder mystery and throwing the first 600 pages away. Well, yeah, you get to the end, but you don't know how you got to the end. You just jump in the middle, and now you're trying to sort things out, and you arrive at erroneous conclusions, and you make up things, and that's where many of the errors have come from. So why is Assyria not in Daniel's list of nations? I mean, Babylon is there, Persia, Hellenism is there and Roman, but why? In fact, probably because it's not in the list means people just never paid it much attention. I never did. It wasn't in the list. But it is important, as I've tried to show here. Well, I think the reason that Assyria was not in that list is because it never controlled Judean territory. If the only commonality I can see here amongst these four kingdoms is the fact that they all controlled Judean territory. First Babylon, then Persia when they defeated Babylon, then Hellenism when it defeated Persia, and then Rome when it defeated Hellenism. They all controlled that part of the world. But Assyria did not. Yes, it attacked Jerusalem, but God protected Jerusalem. And the only thing that happened in Jerusalem is they paid tribute, but their territory was never taken over by the Assyrians. However, the Assyrians did take over Israel, the northern kingdom. It did control that. So as I start off by saying, we have to have an understanding of history. Normative hermeneutics requires some study of ancient history. We're not going to be Bible scholars on that. I mean, we're not going to be experts in history, experts in language, experts in everything. That's somebody else's purview. But we're going to be generalists, which means that we're going to have an understanding of some of the history, an understanding of some of the language, an understanding of God's doctrine, an understanding of God's theology, because this is how we know God. This is how we know Christ. This is how we keep from being held captive by the empty philosophies of the world today, because we understand how they played out yesterday, especially in the Old Testament, where we get to see God behind the scenes. That we miss today. Who's operating today? Well, we're going to see that we oftentimes really don't know. But to do this, we have to know the author's worldview, which is why we have this introductory letter in the ancient world. And one of the problems the author is addressing, if we don't know the culture, we don't know the problems. And if we don't know the problems, we certainly don't know the solutions. So why are you reading the book? And that's where most people say, well, I'm not. And that's true. And that's unfortunate. Because God left that there for us to read and to study and to learn, to grow thereby. And so how can you learn God's true message and relate it to others if you don't know it yourself? So a failure to understand history is really to miss God's message. So this is Jonah's international world. Assyria was a brutal military power in temporary stagnation. Nineveh was a major city and province, but not its capital yet. And repentance of Nineveh would not change Assyria. Nineveh's repentance example to Assyria of truth and of God, Judah's God, not Israel's God, would be rejected when Assyria grew strong again. In other words, the repentance of Nineveh was only temporary. It was only confined to the one area for that one time. And then within a couple of decades or so, it was gone. They were gone. Now remember, Jonah is not preaching Israel's gods, because they're false gods. And in our next lesson, we'll get into that in that whole discussion. But just know that when Jonah is preaching, he's preaching Judah's God, the God of the temple, the God of the tabernacle, the God of Moses and Abraham and Jacob. That's whose God he's preaching. When he goes to Nineveh and say, repent, that's whom he's saying is the God, not Ashur. They might be thinking Ashur, but when he says God and they interact with him, that message has power. Now, Assyria is God's tool for Israel. Pul, the governor of Kalach, which is that was the second capital of Assyria, remember? Well, becomes the second capital because Pul, who was the governor of Kalak, conquers Syria and then deposes the king of Assyria and declares himself as king and takes on the name of Tiglath-Pileser III. And under his leadership, the kingdom grows. I mean, it really grows. And his successor, Shalmaneser V, conquers Israel. And they conquer down into Egypt, in fact. So the Israeli upper society is deported. Now, one priest is returned. Remember, we're talking priests, though. We're not talking a priest from the temple. We're not talking a priest of God. We're talking a false priest of the land. But to the Assyrians, it's all the same. They said the land is getting overrun by lions because people aren't worshiping the god of the land like they're supposed to because they're ignorant of it. So bring back one of the priests so he can teach them how to worship. And they did so, and he taught them, and the people had both some smattering of understanding of God as well as their own current idolatry that they brought with them when they were imported in from other places. And so you had this real mishmash of amalgamation, of confusion, of religions blending together. And from this, Samaria comes into being in Christ's time. Now, the upper classes were, of course, exported or deported to other lands. And then from other lands, that upper crust was brought into Israel. Which means there never was a case for 10 lost tribes. That's a myth. The tribes were never lost. By and large, they never left. They were still there. The bulk of society never left. Now, once you take away that myth, Mormonism falls apart. Because according to Joseph Smith, I believe, the Indians were the 10 lost tribes of Israel. In the 19th century, some Brits believed they were the 10 lost tribes of Israel. And they say, well, the 10 lost tribes are here or there or whatever. And so you see where a lack of knowledge, a lack of understanding of the Old Testament can do great harm, terrible damage, and cause error that promulgates down through the years. That's why I implore people, understand something about the Old Testament. That's why I do these lessons. That's why I put them up on Sermon Audio and on my own website to try to get it out there so that people have some understanding of it. It's important. It's vital. God wrote it. And he left it in the scriptures, so it must be important. It has to be. And if it's important to him as his children, it should also be important to us. Because when we say that his word is not important to us, we're actually saying that he is not important to us. So I want you to think about that. Meditate on that. No one's asking you to be an expert in the Old Testament, but we are imploring you to have some understanding of it. And that's why we do these lessons. I look forward to talking to you again in our next lesson when we will look specifically at Israel, the Northern Kingdom. Thank you.